You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
You're listening to Muses and Stuff. This is the podcast that's all about the dolls. They were the groupies, the wives, the girlfriends, and the muses who played such a huge role in rock and roll history by simply being themselves.
They were sweet, sexy, brave, and powerful. They went after what and who they wanted, and they made no apologies.
We are your hosts, Shanti and Lynx.
Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
This episode is brought to you by Electrified Porcupine. Electrified Porcupine is a pretty kick-ass website where you can go and read and learn all about music, gaming, wrestling, retro, TV, movies, cartoons, and collectible toys. So go to electrifiedporcupine.com and have a look around. See what you like. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Lynx.
Hi. I'm real excited about this one.
I'm really excited, too, because once again, it's about people that I have no idea about.
Yeah.
So it's going to be all completely new information. Mm-hmm. And last night, Link sent me some videos on...
A little homework.
So a little bit of homework online. She's like, you ever heard of this person? You ever heard of this person? You must have heard of this person, but check out these videos in preparation for tomorrow. And I said, okay, Link. And I did.
Yes. Well... Good. We're taking a little trip down to the Punk Avenue, I guess, of England.
Let's go there. Yeah. Actually, before we go there, can I just tell you one thing?
Yeah.
I wanted to wait until we were recording, until I told you. But as you know, we'll tell listeners, my dad is visiting right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went into where he is, and he's listening to our podcast.
Aww.
Yeah, he never misses a week.
My dad's the same. My dad's exactly the same.
But it's just kind of funny because I walked in, and all of a sudden I heard your voice again, and I was like, what? That's nice.
Oh,
so thanks to my dad, sweet. And thanks to our dads once again for being ultimate supporters.
Yes, and it was so nice to
both emotionally
finally meet
and financially. My dad was like, "I want to sponsor your podcast," and I said, "Okay, Daddy, thank you."
He's such a sweetheart. So, this episode is all about a woman named Viv Albertine.
Okay, sweet name.
Yes, she was part of a band called The Slits. We'll get to that. In due time.
Quite a name.
Yeah. She's got an amazing, amazing book called Closed Music Boys.
Oh.
And
okay.
I read...
Closed, comma, music, comma.
It's actually, boys. If you look at the book, it looks like it's called Closed, 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 Music, 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 Boys, Boys, Boys.
I like it.
Yes. But short form, Closed Music Boys. But yes.
Okay.
In the back of her book, she sort of... lists out her life, each section of her life through her favorite clothes of that time, what music was inspiring her, and
of course
the boys. Yeah, it's really cool. She's an incredible writer. I highly recommend her book. I gave it 5 stars. It was like it moved me so much. And I actually read it twice. I read it last year, and then I read it again to do this episode. And she's wonderful, and I'm really excited to tell you about her.
Lay it on me.
So she was born.
I'm in full relaxed
yeah.
position.
She was born December 1st, 1954, and she was raised in North London. Always growing up, she was attracted to the arts and particularly music. But she was in an era and a place where women weren't rock stars. And she thought she could not be one. So she kind of focused on maybe being a pop star. And so that was like her childhood dream. But then one day her dad was like, you have no talent for that. Like, you're never going to make it.
Oh, like the opposite of our dads.
Yeah, exactly. Go to school, do something like normal, whatever that means. And so he was really never supportive of her music. But she really idolized John Lennon, and she really loved Yoko Ono, too. And she actually thought about, maybe I'll become a groupie, because that's it, like, she felt the only way that women could even touch the rock and roll
really?
Scene.
Really? I've never heard of somebody thinking, maybe I'll become a groupie.
Yeah.
Because for us and all of the women that we've talked to, it's just like,
it's natural.
We just were.
Yeah.
Like, I was before I even knew it.
And that's probably why she, you know, wouldn't be necessarily categorized in that category. She's definitely a rock star. But yeah, she wanted the rock and roll life so much, and she just did not see a way in except, you know, to be the girl at this, like, the groupie.
Yeah, it's one of the ways.
But in 1974, when she was about 20 now, she started attending Hammersmith College, which is now Chelsea College of the Arts, and she was studying fashion and textiles. And another person that happened to be going to school there was Mick Jones. Now, Mick Jones is the lead guitarist of The Clash. Mm. Or he's a guitarist of The Clash, and he also sings. But not yet. He's just another student.
He's just plain old Mick Jones,
yes.
student at Chelsea Prep, or
yes.
whatever it was called.
So she saw him across the room, and she like immediately knew she'd found a kindred soul. He was very tall. Kind of like another Mick Fleetwood. Very tall, very lanky. He had his own fashion sense. He had like wild hair. And he actually kind of reminds me of a like young Tim Burton a little bit. He had that like dark goth, but like pre-goth kind of thing going on. But she knew he was an original. And they ended up dating pretty much soon after that. In 1975, two major things happen for Viv. First, she discovers Patti Smith in the magazine Enemy. She said, "She is my soul made visible. All things I hide deep inside myself that can't come out. She looks natural, confident, sexy, and an individual. I don't want to dress or copy her style. She gives me the confidence to express myself in my own way." So,
nice.
Yeah, seeing a woman kind of doing what the rock thing kind of opened her eyes, like, oh, wait a minute. There are women out there who have pushed past this, you know, barrier. The other big thing, she was starting to get involved in the punk scene and the fashion scene. And Viv became good friends with a man named Malcolm McLaren. Now, Malcolm is pretty much responsible for the New York punk fashion coming over to England.
And what fashion would that be?
Ripped shirts, safety pins, wild kind of messy hair, tight jeans, you know, like think like Ramones and like those types
got
of
it.
Things.
I've got the picture in my mind. Yep.
And Malcolm was dating a woman that you might know, Vivian Westwood.
Yes, I'm familiar.
Yes. And Vivian, she had the only punk boutique in Chelsea, and it was called Sex. And that was where...
It was just called Sex.
Yes. Every punker in England, that's where they bought all their clothes, basically. And a couple of the...
How old was she, do you think?
I'm not sure, but 20s? Younger, yeah, 20s, mm-hmm. maybe early 30s. Yeah, because she's only maybe like 60s, 70s now, right? Maybe older. So a couple of the people who shopped there, of course, were Johnny Rotten and Steve Jones and people like that. So Malcolm is also kind of responsible for the Sex Pistols forming the way that they did with those members, because they would all hang out there. And so Malcolm is a pretty influential character in the, especially in the British punk scene, for sure.
Right.
So she's good friends with Malcolm, and he invited her to go see the Sex Pistols. And she said it was just a revelatory experience. She said seeing these guys with like zero technique, no training, they were just up there being themselves. They didn't give a shit. She said, "At last, I see not only the other universe that I've always wanted to be a part of, but the bridge to it."
Nice.
Yes.
Oh, I love the image right? of the bridge. Right? It came up in my tarot reading for July.
Cool.
So I'm trying to think if we're still in July when this episode is out.
Yes, I think we are. It's the last week in July.
So bridge was the catalyst card.
Cool. It's all coming together.
Everybody should think about that.
So in 75, another big thing is happening. Mick is putting together his own band, The Clash. And the band tends to meet at Viv's place because Paul Simonon, I'm sorry.
We went over it before. Do we think it's Simonon or Simonon? And we really feel like it could go both ways.
Yeah.
So we really just don't want to offend anybody.
No.
So that's why we're doing, we give.
And I adore The Clash. You can quiz me, but I'm not good with last names, okay?
Okay, speaking of quizzing you, this is a serious question. And I might be embarrassing myself a little bit. But out of The Clash and the Sex Pistols and the Buzzcocks, mm-hmm. which one was the most famous? Had most, like, I guess, commercial success?
I think The Clash are probably considered universally the best band and the most influential and everything. The Sex Pistols weren't really around that long. They sort of burnt out pretty quick. But yeah. The Clash went on into, like, the 80s and even, like, the 90s until Joe Strummer kind of, but Joe Strummer's just everyone's idol in that world. And
okay,
yeah.
What about the Buzzcocks?
They're kind of like cultish. They're not as big as The Clash for sure.
Okay.
I would say The Clash is the biggest.
There's no such thing as a stupid question, guys.
No, not at all.
Just don't be afraid to ask. I'm sure if I was thinking it, other listeners were thinking it too.
Yes. So,
okay.
Yeah, Viv is sort of in the middle of seeing The Clash being formed and everything, and she's wanting that world too, but again, she knows it's there, but she's not quite sure how to get it yet. But then in 76... Viv's grandma passed away, and she left her 200 quid in her will. So immediately she knows what she wants to do. She heads to the music shop. She says she's terrified of being laughed out of the store, but Mick accompanies her, and she bought a 250-pound 1969 Les Paul Jr.
Good choice.
Yes. And carrying it home, she said, "For the first time in my life, I feel like myself."
Excellent.
Yes. So she loves her guitar. She starts playing it every chance she gets. She's trying to develop her own sound. Unfortunately, it's not a sound her neighbors are a fan of. And she says that they came by and begged her to stop. One said, "Please, for your own sake, Viv, as well as everyone else's, stop playing and find something that you can do."
Oh, what a... Oh.
Right? Luckily, Viv doesn't listen. She's like, fuck that. No. So... going back to her and Mick's relationship, they're very, very different when it comes to what they want out of one. Mick is more traditional. He wants commitment. He wants to be openly affectionate. Viv is really scared of that. She cares about him, but those feelings aren't something she's kind of... she feels okay addressing just yet.
Why? What happened to her?
Well, she actually says that she doesn't really... She wants to be known... she doesn't want to be known as Mick's girlfriend in the scene.
Fair enough.
Yeah, she wants to prove herself as an individual. So yeah, it's not like she's embarrassed or anything, but yeah, she doesn't like holding his hand in front of other guys. Like she wants to be her own self.
What, you know what? Wise choice.
Exactly. Yeah. And they're very much a breakup makeup couple. Again, they're like early 20s, fighting and then making up, and we all know stupid teenage.
Well, somebody very close to me started working in the music industry and refused to date anybody in the industry or near it for, I don't know, 4 years.
Did she date anyone?
But they weren't involved in music because she wanted to be taken
seriously.
Yeah. And although I'm like, well, I think you can date people and still be taken seriously, I hope. The fact of the matter is I don't work professionally in music. Yeah. So I can date as many rocks. No.
And like she said, she wanted to prove herself first.
But it makes sense. And it's still happening to this day. I know that girls in music are.
So something happens, though, that makes her finally kind of realize, oh, my God, I really do love him. And that's when Steve Jones, who's a Sex Pistol, he was flirting with her one night and they ended up going into like a hallway at this club. And they were like just about to kind of kiss or something was just about to happen. But Mick walked in and saw them. So she didn't actually cheat on him, but he witnessed her like about to kind of cheat. And she like begged for his forgiveness, and that kind of really made her realize, oh my God, I'm in love with this man, like I don't want to lose him. But she did actually hook up with another Sex Pistol. She Ooh. Said when she was 22 she gave her first ever blowjob to Johnny Rotten. And in the book it's so, I love that she admits this because you know how embarrassing it must have been to write and to experience it. But she says like she had no, it was her first ever and she had no idea what she was doing. And while she was in the middle of it, like Rotten actually stopped her and was like, you're trying too hard.
Oh.
And like that was it.
Wow. Yeah. So she's going to town, just trying her best.
Yeah. And he was like, no, this isn't working.
Just like that guitar. Yeah. Find something else that you're good at or just practice.
Exactly. And so yeah, she did hook up with Johnny, but whatever. So at this point Viv's like, I want to focus on my music. I'm gonna leave college. One day she's out on the street and she runs into Johnny Rotten, who's with his friend Sid.
Ooh.
Now Sid, it will become Sid Vicious, but he's not a Sex Pistol yet. And Viv has never met him. But she's chatting with these two guys and she says that she's trying to kind of form her own band. And immediately Sid's like, I'll join. So they go around together and they ask a couple of her girlfriends to join as well. And Joe Strummer offers his basement for them to rehearse. And a band is formed and they call themselves the Flowers of Romance.
A little different from the Slits. Yeah. I feel like a little bit of juxtaposition there between
it's
those
interesting.
Two.
It's an interesting.
But were they being ironic?
I think they just loved the way it sounded.
Maybe it sounds different like with an English
musical,
accent.
Maybe. So
let's call Simeon.
Viv is on guitar and Sid was actually the front man. So they're rehearsing, they're doing their own thing. In 1977, Johnny Thunders, who was part of the New York Dolls and then later had his own band, Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, they come to England, Johnny and the Heartbreakers, and Viv goes to see them at the Roxy. And I have a big paragraph here and I'm going to just read it directly out of her book because it is so beautifully written and I know you're going to feel it. Like,
okay.
Okay. I stand at the front to soak up the band. I want to see Johnny's fingers on his guitar, watch his face as he sings, check out his moves. Johnny shakes his head and pouts. He holds his guitar like it's glued to him. He fixes his dark brown eyes on me. How great! Johnny Thunders looked at me from the stage. He doesn't look away. He sings the whole song looking into my eyes. This is a sort of daydream I've been having since I was a little girl, and Johnny Thunders has made it come true. I smile at him at the end of the song. It's the most romantic thing that's ever happened to me. Johnny Thunders understands romance and big gestures. Johnny doesn't take his eyes off my face. He sings this next song to me, too. I'm rooted to the spot. I can't believe what's happening. This is the way to win a girl. He sings the whole set to me, every song straight into my eyes. He changes the words to "I can't keep my eyes on you" to "I can't keep my eyes off you." The band doesn't seem to mind. I think they understand romance, too.
Ooh, and who said punk can't be romantic?
Exactly.
Nobody said that, because it is.
Yeah. So after the set. Yeah, right? Yeah. You feel it, right? Mm-hmm. After the set, Johnny walked over to her and asked what she's doing later. And she invited him and Jerry Nolan, who also was a New York doll and now in The Heartbreakers.
Okay. I can't just let The Heartbreakers pass me by without asking a couple of questions.
Yeah.
So there were two Heartbreakers bands. Yeah. Huh? And there was no argument over that? No fighting? Hey, there's a band that also is da-da-da in the Heartbreakers?
I've never heard anything where that has ever come up. And
because remind me what year we're in?
Like 76.
Yeah, the Heartbreakers were already, Top 8 Heartbreakers were already formed and releasing yep. stuff.
Okay. Maybe just different genre.
Okay.
So they go back to her house and she ends up making them tea, and Thunders is playing her songs, like 60s girl groups like Baby It's You and Walking in the Sand, and they end up kissing, and she says that Thunders actually shouted to Nolan, "I felt something." Like he tells her, I haven't felt this way in a long time. He says he has to call someone in New York and tell them. She doesn't say who, but Johnny Thunders also dated Sable Starr in New York.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if she's the person that he called, but I wonder if that
How old was Sable in 76?
Nine. Still a teenager, I believe. Yeah.
I'm excited to do an episode on her.
Yeah, she's awesome. Anyway, they go to bed together, but Thunders is a junkie, so
I was gonna ask yeah. you, like, a lot of his behavior and a lot of stuff he's saying sounds pretty yeah. drugged out.
Okay. So they don't have sex, they just, you know, talk all night and kind of, you know, touch each other, they're intimate. She says, "It feels like we're meant to be together. If he wasn't a junkie, I think I would have something special, or we would. I'm as close to falling in love as you can be with an addict." So she's still on and off with Mick at this point, but her and Thunder's chemistry is just so overpowering to her. So the flowers of romance are still rehearsing, and Thunder's is kind of rooted in England for a little bit right now. So it's not just one night gig and gone. So one day Johnny Thunders calls her and she's like, "You should come over." And when she arrives, Thunders tells her that Sid had confided in him that he was going to kick her out of the band.
But it's her band.
Yeah. So she's devastated, and Thunders offered her some heroin. And
don't do it, Viv.
She did. She immediately puked, and so she went to meet Sid, and she got kicked out of her own band while she was high off her ass. That's really the only time she ever did it, though. So
okay, good.
It's not going down that direction. It wasn't long after that, though, that Sid would leave that band, too, and replace Glenn Matlack on bass in the Sex Pistols. And this was at Viv's encouragement. She didn't hold it against him. They still remained friends. And she actually talks about this amazing thing where she says that Sid had never played bass before. And she says that she watched Sid in one night learn how to play by listening to the Ramones songs and playing along by ear. So that's all the practice he took to get into the sex pistol.
Crazy. How does he know where to put the fingers?
Yeah, he just, she did it like all night. And I mean, he wasn't, when he joined the Sex Pistols, he still wasn't like a good bass player, but he was adequate enough to get by in the punk scene.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, yeah, they're still friends. Soon after this, Nancy Spungen arrives in England, and she's there the night her and Sid hook up, and she says, like, she's so shocked that Sid chose her. And she also says that from what she knows, Sid had never done heroin before until Nancy came into the picture. Though some people might be surprised that Sid's mother was actually a junkie, like, long before Sid was.
I didn't know that.
But from that moment on, Sid and Nancy are Sid and Nancy. They're a duo. And the Pistols went on tour in America in 1978, and Sid actually asked her, Viv, to hang out with Nancy because no one wanted to hang out with Nancy ever. And so she hung out with her once. She kind of called the experience torture, just Nancy's annoying, you know. She's kind-hearted, but annoying, I guess. But she confided in Nancy that she'd never had an orgasm before. And then when Sid came back, Nancy had told him, and they went to her together. And Sid was like, I'm so grateful you visited Nancy. You were the only one who did. I want to, like, thank you and, like, give you a reward. Like, I'll sleep with you and give you an orgasm. And Nancy was like, go for it. Like, you know, get your orgasm. But she was like, no thanks.
My God.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? Like, I feel like after we've just, like, I talked about our dad so much in this episode, I was going to be like, girl, you just go and get that orgasm and, like, let me tell you how, but I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And next time if I want to talk about orgasms, let's just not mention our dads at the top of the show, okay?
She does say that she's never seen Sid so soft and affectionate and protective, and that he truly did love Nancy. And she said that though the experience of trying to be her friend might have been torture, she thinks everyone deserves love, even Nancy.
Even annoying Nancy.
Yes. So Mick and her are very on and off. Her and Thunders kind of don't know what's happening there. One night she went to a gig and both of them were there, and they kind of had that standoff, like, is it me or is it him? And she was like, fuck you both. And she left alone.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Or like, fuck you both?
No, not that way. Okay. And so she's upset about the band, but shortly after, an all-girl punk band called The Slits asked her, like, hey, like, do you want to join? Like, we need a guitar player. She really isn't sure about the all girl thing. I think she didn't like want that to sort of cloud the music, like they're a girl group or whatever. She went to her friend Chrissy Hind for advice.
Cool.
And Chrissy, she's a musician who wants to be in a band as well, but doesn't quite have a band just yet. But she tells Viv, go for it. So Viv joins. And immediately they click and they start jamming and writing. And in 1977, the Slits went on a little tour with the Clash and the Buzzcocks.
Cool.
Yeah. So unfortunately, though, on this tour, Mick broke up with her. And she caught him in bed with another woman. And then she discovered, like, he was cheating on her for longer than that in the worst way possible. She got crabs. So she has an experience in the book, and I'm not going to go through that, but it's an interesting one. She also discovered that she was pregnant with Mick's child. She's 24, and she ends up having an abortion.
Well, yeah, because she wants to rock out.
Exactly. So the Slits song Ping Pong Affair, she actually wrote about her split with Mick. And Mick, in turn, writes one of the Clash's biggest songs, Train in Vain. So she says that he used to take the tube out to her apartment in Shepherd's Bush, and if they were in a fight, she wouldn't let him in, and he'd be stuck on her doorstep. So, like, train in vain. And she also, the Slits also had a song called Typical Girls, and one of the lyrics she wrote were, "Typical girls stand by their man." And then, of course, in Train in Vain, Mick sings, "You didn't stand by me." Mm-hmm. No, not at all, right? So things are good with the band, though, the Slits. John Walters and John Peel asked them to be on the BBC, and the band made their first album shortly after that as well. And when the Clash went to New York, they invited them for a 2-week residency opening for them. So when they're at this point, Mick is now dating Ellen Foley, who most people might recognize her voice as the female in Meatloaf's Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Oh, funny.
Yeah. And Viv also is dating a new man, Gareth Sager, from the band The Pop Group. So things with the Slits, they were good. They were signed. They made a couple music videos. They can be seen in the cult film Jubilee. They were touring, but in 1981, their label just suddenly dropped them. And she actually found out while being interviewed by a journalist. The journalist was like, "What do you think of?" I think it was Island Records. And she was like, "They're great." And he was like, "But they just dropped you." And that's how she found out.
Gross.
Yeah. So that, and there were a couple tensions in the band and stuff. And they ended up splitting in 82. They pieced together sessions and they finished another album, I believe, but they couldn't get a label to pick them up, and they played their last show in December 81. So by 82, they were gone. Viv is just heartbroken. She's devastated. Music and the band were her life. She really can't see a future. She spends a couple of years just kind of trying to find her place. It was right in the Jane Fonda aerobics kind of craze, and she ended up being an aerobics teacher for a while.
Oh, cool.
She began attending night classes at a music college to, you know, learn how to read music and things like that. But she needed more of a creative outlet.
And, especially once you've got the taste for it.
Right.
Like that adrenaline and the
Well, it's interesting because... And- Instead of music, I guess she was maybe too hurt from everything that just happened. She decided to go instead into film. And she went to the London College of Printing for a degree in film. And from 1983 to 1988, she was working in film. She graduated. She was shooting a lot of music videos for a brand new channel called MTV.
Heyo.
Yeah. And she was also working for the BBC, and she's doing her own short films and commercials and TV episodes.
Good for
her. Yeah. And of course, though, she kind of soon discovered the movie business is just as bad as the music when it comes to sexism and things like that. So she does have struggles along the way, and she does talk about them in the book. Around 1990, she began dating a biker who she never actually names in the book. You don't ever know his name. So at first, he's just known as, like, the biker. So he's 27. She's 36 at this point. One day when she's working on set...
Oh, he's 27. She's 36?
Yeah.
Nice one.
Yeah. So one day she's on set and she begins bleeding. And she found out that she was pregnant and it was a miscarriage. But after the miscarriage and everything, she still felt like she was pregnant. She still kind of felt something was wrong. And she ended up again bleeding severely, and she ended up at the hospital. It turned out that she was still pregnant and the baby was developing in her fallopian tube.
Ugh.
And had it ruptured, she would have bled to death.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was, they had to perform emergency surgery. They had to cut it out. 2 weeks after the surgery, her and the biker got married. She says she had staples in her stomach and she couldn't even stand up straight, but she was happy. She was in love and, you know, they were going to move on with their life. So unfortunately as well, Viv at this point desperately wanted a child. And for the next few years, that's her entire focus was on having a baby. She would begin IVF treatments. For years, she would get pregnant and then miscarry, pregnant, miscarry, just over and over and over again. She wants a child so badly, she just refuses to give up. And she ended up like auctioning off all of her memorabilia from the punk scene, letters Sid had written her, things from the slits, just everything. And she kind of gave up her career too, to pay for the IVF and everything, right?
Yeah.
But in 1999, she finally gets what she's always dreamed of, and she has a beautiful daughter.
Oh.
So it worked out for her. So her daughter's 3 months old, and Viv began bleeding again. And she found out she had cervical cancer, and apparently it was a miracle she was even alive, because something instinctive in her, right before she was about to deliver, she was like, no, I need a cesarean section. I need to do it that way. And she did. And she found out that decision had saved her life, because, again, she would have bled to death otherwise because of the cancer. They didn't know it was
okay.
There.
Okay.
Yeah. So always trust your instincts. They're there yeah. for a purpose. So in the book, she's incredibly open about her battle with cancer and all the depression that kind of came from that, and the guilt of being a new mother who cannot care for her child. She said at one point, I watched the intense bond I had with my daughter slip away. I'm losing the child I fought so hard to have in my life. And she was so determined that that wouldn't happen, that she fought with all her might that she wouldn't lose the bond. And slowly her daughter and like kind of came back to her, and she begins getting stronger and starts to kind of see hope on the horizon. And her family moves away from London, and they move to Hastings for like a quieter kind of life. And Viv sort of got back into art. Once her battle with cancer was at the point where she could go out again and sort of begin building a life again, she started taking ceramics at the Hastings Art School, and her teacher sort of became a mentor. And she also began exercising and eating healthy, and she became strong again. But the stronger she became, the more her relationship with her husband kind of was crumbling.
What?
Yeah. And at one point, like when she started to realize things weren't ideal, she said during an argument, her husband said, I own you. And she was like, I don't want to be owned. I don't want to be a Stepford wife. She's kind of beginning to feel trapped.
You don't own me, biker.
No.
I own me.
Yeah. Then one day, you know, she's got this cozy, quiet world. She gets a letter from a man named Vincent Gallo. Now,
Vincent Gallo.
Anyone who doesn't know who Vincent Gallo is, he's a writer, an actor, a director. He's a musician and an all-around weirdo.
I didn't know until you sent me the videos, and I was like, this guy looks very familiar.
Yeah, he's in lots of films, and his
total weirdo.
Yeah, his crowning glory would be a film called Buffalo 66, which he wrote and directed and acted in with Christina Ricci.
She's so good.
Yeah, I love her. And he's phenomenal. And this whole film is just beautiful. I highly recommend it to everyone. But yeah, if you want to learn about Gallo, just go online. And actually, I have a funny story about Vincent Gallo.
Let's hear it.
When I was a teenager, I guess I saw Buffalo 66, and he's such an individual and an artist. And I was like, this guy, like, this art. And I kind of, like, swooned over it. And I used to email him. Yeah.
Oh, my God. How'd you get his email address?
Because he has a website.
Oh, fair enough.
And, yeah, I think he likes getting contacted by people and stuff. I don't know if he still does.
Let's see.
Yeah. But I used to write him these, like, long, passionate, like, only Vincent Gallo will understand this. I don't even want to read what I wrote him. But he would always reply, and I guess it was sort of like Pamela with the Brando thing.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I could just imagine you seeing his name in your email inbox and your little heart just dropping.
Right.
And then reading it really, really, really quickly. And then reading it over again. And then going back to it an hour and reading it again.
That's probably exactly.
That's what happens when you get emails from people. That yes. You-
so Viv sort of has a similar experience to mine. So she gets this email or this letter that Vincent wants to chat with her. Now her husband is like, oh my god, Vincent Gallo wants to chat with you? Like, that's awesome. But she's kind of suspicious of it. Like, what is this guy? Like, why does he want to talk to me? Viv definitely suffers a little bit from that imposter syndrome thing that we talk about a lot, where like her confidence isn't at a point where it should be, considering, you know, all she's done. So she's like, I don't know, like I have nothing for him type of thing. But eventually her suspicions lessen and the kind of nerves take over. But finally she calls him after weeks and weeks of stalling, and of course they instantly hit it off, and it ignites this feeling in her that she kind of had long forgotten. And over the weeks they kind of become phone buddies, and through their chats she sort of begins to rediscover her old self and a new self kind of. And one day Vincent said to her, like, Viv, like, do something, like, you're talented, like, you should be putting that talent kind of out in the world. And she said, Vincent Gallo believing in me is like a secret door being opened again to a world I left a long time ago. So their calls are really inspiring to her, though she's starting to feel emotionally unfaithful for sharing things with Vincent that she really doesn't share with her husband. And her husband's definitely noticing and isn't too pleased about it either.
Because he owns her.
Yes. But it really isn't Vincent she's finding passion in, but the way he makes her feel about herself.
Yeah.
And her husband's like, no, like, he actually said, like, you've had your life, like, now it's our daughter's turn, like your life's over. And she's 48 at this point. So in 2008, she's like, this is my year. I'm going to say yes to everything. The year of saying yes. And in this year, she hears from a woman who's writing a book about the Slits. And she actually hears from her former bandmates, who are now in a new band called the New Slits. It's sort of like a little bit of a reunion. And they're playing in New York, and they invited Viv to come out and see them. And they're actually playing at a gig for Chloe Segnivi, who dated Vincent Gallo. And they have a lot of people might know Vincent Gallo also from his movie The Brown Bunny, in which Chloe gives him a blowjob. There's lots of blowjob talk in this. And it wasn't like simulated.
And they filmed it.
Yes. And it was a big like uproar at Cannes. I think people walked out and it became a big thing.
Squares.
Yeah. So it was kind of interesting that it happened to be Chloe. So she's thinking, well, maybe I'll see Vincent there. And so she goes to New York, and she did end up meeting with Vincent for dinner. And she talks about kind of their time together, and it was pretty awkward because she didn't want to be unfaithful. She didn't want to, like, you know, have an affair or anything, but she had this connection, so the tension's there and everything. But it's only when they're in person that she realizes that Vincent cannot truly give her what she's looking for, which is, you know, herself.
Totally.
Yeah.
Always, guys. It's always and then, what you're looking
yes,
for.
Yes, exactly. And then the universe handed her this unbelievable sign. She's sitting there at this Chinese restaurant, I think she said, or Japanese restaurant, with Vincent Gallo, and it's empty. It's like just the two of them. And she's kind of having this epiphany, like, fuck, what am I doing here? Like, what am I doing with my life? And in walked Patti Smith.
No
yeah.
way.
Yeah. She mentions that Patti and Vincent kind of gave each other like a nod, but she kind of got the feeling that there is some tension there. So she didn't actually talk to Patti Smith, but just like seeing her at that moment was like, whoa, okay, this was my idol. This is the woman who kind of... And
wonder what the hell is going on between Vincent and Patty.
I don't know. But if you know, if you look up Vincent, like, he's an interesting person. Not the type to kind of get along with everyone. Let's put it that way. And so between seeing Patty and then seeing the new Slits that night perform at Webster Hall, she realizes, I need to start playing again. Like, music is my passion. So she, when she goes back to England, she starts playing guitar again, and she has to learn from scratch. She can't remember anything. So she starts to take lessons, and she kind of begins to feel more confident. And then one day she mentioned to the guy who was helping her with the guitar that she'd written a couple songs. So she played them to him, and she sang to him, and he was like, wow, this is incredible. Like, you got to do this. But she's like, no, well, no, I can't. And she doesn't believe in herself, but he does. And so that's sort of enough to kind of keep pushing her to play music and stuff. And she also has a huge support in her daughter, who's now 8 years old.
Aww.
And she said that one day her daughter said to her, Mommy, you were born to play guitar.
Kids know.
Right? And she says, that phrase and the way she says it sustains me for years. So she also begins vocal lessons and slowly starts playing open mics. And over time, she becomes stronger and braver and finally begins to feel like a front woman and not just a guitarist. So about a year and a half after the open mics, she actually did play with her old bandmates in the new Slits, and her daughter got to go see her rock out with her original band. But she realizes she wants to play her own music, and that the Slits tunes kind of they no longer resonate with her, because that was so long ago and she's at a different point. So the Raincoats asked her to go on a short tour with them in the U.S. and she's terrified, but she says yes. And of course, by the end of her first night out there, she didn't want to leave the stage and finally felt back at home. And you can actually go on YouTube. There's a video of her on that tour in 2009 playing in Brooklyn at the Knitting Factory, and she plays a song called Confessions of a MILF.
Oh my.
Right? And it's great. Ooh. So I highly recommend that.
Okay.
But unfortunately, her husband is like really, really not supportive at all. And eventually he kind of gives her an ultimatum, like him or the music. She says that he said, you're useless. You're too old. This is a waste of time.
He would say that.
Right? She said, the two most important men in my life want me to deny who I am. Right?
Mm-hmm.
When her father passed away, which was recent, like soon after this, he left what was left of his money. He was in France, and apparently in France, you have to leave your money to your children. She used most of that money on a divorce lawyer. She finally separated from her husband, and she used the rest to make a little EP of her songs.
Wow.
And
it's like one of those examples and like of how like money coming to you when you need it the most.
When you need it. Yeah, absolutely. Same with like her guitar all those years earlier. She's only inherited money twice, and both she uses to propel her music.
Cool.
Yeah. She also met up with an old friend, Mick Jones.
Hey.
He came to see her play, and he offers to record her song, Confession of a MILF. So she went to the studio with him and a bunch of other musicians that she'd kind of known all her life. And she said she was like so honored that all of them were there for her and wanted to play with her. And she said, this is one of the best days in my life, and it all happens because of Mick.
Nice. So,
again, we always talk about it's great when you can maintain relationships with people that you used to have a real relationship with and love.
Continue to inspire each other,
exactly.
Too.
And
yeah, there was a lot of, like, obviously a lot of shit guys in the story, like, you know, dad and biker. But other than that, there seemed to be a lot of really supportive.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, supportive men. And, like, there's a whole lot of, like, muses and stuff happening in this episode.
Exactly.
Like in her life. So yep. That's pretty cool. And from a lot of different perspectives.
In 2012, she released her album, The Vermilion Border. She financed it by crowdfunding, and she made artwork and sculptures to send to all the people who made pledges for it.
Great.
And in 2013, she also faced another fear. She starred alongside Liam Gillick and Tom Hiddleston in a film called Exhibition, which was directed by her friend Joanna Hogg. She plays one of the leads. Her friend was like, you're right for this role. And in it, not only is she naked a bunch of times, but there's lots of close-ups, and she barely wears any makeup. And, you know, she's like in her 50s now. So she's talking about like how that was another fear to kind of face, like putting yourself out
there.
I'd
say so.
Yeah. And so, yeah, she's just kicking ass. And in 2014, she released her book, Closed Music Boys. And you guys have to read it. As you can tell from the quotes I've lifted out of it, she's an incredible writer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Viv is still kicking ass. She continues to perform. And she did something ultimately punk last year.
What'd she do? What'd you do, Viv?
In England, they had this big punk exhibition, and they had this big poster up naming all the influential bands of the punk scene, ignoring all the women. It was like The Clash, The Buzzcocks, The Sex Pistols. So Viv took a black marker, X'd out their names, and wrote in all the female punk bands that just keep getting ignored.
Good for you, punk as fuck.
Right? So, yeah, still kicking ass.
Good. Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
I love that story.
And I'm sure her daughter, who's now, I think, around 18.
Yeah.
They probably have a great relationship. And yeah, check out Viv. She's on social media, and there's plenty of music videos and things like that she's done on YouTube.
Amazing. Yeah. That was a really great story.
Yeah.
I learned a lot.
Awesome.
I'm enjoying learning about punk scene and stuff through you.
Mm-hmm.
And Viv does kick ass.
Yeah.
And I really do want to watch Buffalo 66.
Anytime, I got it.
Okay. Amazing. Perfect. So let's watch Buffalo 66, Sleepover at Your House, and you read me those emails you sent to Vincent Gallo.
Oh, God. I don't even know if I want to revisit those.
When Lynx is asleep, I'm going to steal her computer, and I'm going to secretly read the emails that she sent to Vincent Gallo.
Oh, lordy.
Okay, well, as always, everybody, thank you so much for listening. We hope you had a great time.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you so much, Lynx, for all of the research and hard work that you put into that.
Of course, anytime.
Okay, we'll see y'all next week.
See ya.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new, or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. Steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica, the Heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.